will challenge our entrenched beliefs. If you think that all foreigners are untrustworthy, then it is certain you will meet lots of them who are, as you will never notice any others. Yoga calls this misperception, and it is a lot more dangerous and difficult to eradicate than the simple misperception of misreading the number of your bus because you've forgotten your glasses. The yogic analysis of the workings of consciousness, supported by practice, enables us to live philosophically, deliberately and wisely in ordinary life, and whenever life presents extraordinary challenges and opportunities, we will be prepared to handle those too. Next, we will continue our exploration of intelligence and how it can lead us to true wisdom. Wisdom, the intellectual body. When the mind leads to thoughts, the intellect leads to intelligence and ultimately wisdom. Yoga identifies these different parts of our consciousness along with their accompanying fluctuations, vrittis, in such a way that we can use them both to give our journey direction and to result in our transformation. In this way, we discover the ability to refuse ice cream or to accept it, but in quantities which will not be harmful. We increasingly develop judicious discrimination, which, harnessed to self-control, enables us to set sail in uncharted waters. On the inner frontier of this fourth sheath lies the discovery of the individual soul, Jiva Atman, that spark of divinity which resides in all of us, in our divine body. In between these two borders of deepening self-knowledge and the culture of higher intelligence, pure insight rests. Here comes the culmination of the exploration of the whole of our being as an individual. This can only be accomplished by eliminating the impurities of intelligence and increasing subjugation of the cunning superego that remains always the insecure ego, or I shape. The yogic tools which will facilitate this leg of our journey are the sixth and seventh petals of yoga, concentration, dharana, and meditation, dhyana. All the other petals we have studied so far, from asana to pratyahara, will also always be present, supporting the high achievements which to a great extent depend on them. For example, if you want to meditate, you have to sit in an asana. If you want to meditate, you have to be able to detach the mind and senses from the outer world and direct their energies inwards, pratyahara. If you neglect the base, you are like someone sitting in a great tree, sawing off the branch he is sitting on. It is often more difficult to describe asana and pranayama in words than it is such concepts as insight, ego, and duality. The problem is rather that conscious awareness of these matters tends to lie outside our day-to-day experience, so they may appear abstract. They are not. They are very real. Nevertheless, an effort of imaginative intelligence is necessary to track them down and confront them. Let me offer an analogy. Air is the element which corresponds to the sheath of intelligence and touches the subtle counterpart to air in our system of evolutionary theory. Imaginatively, let us explore why and how this makes sense. We bathe in air all day and all night. Air is always against our skin. With every breath, air permeates the interior of our body, just as water does to a fish. Air always touches us inwardly as well as outwardly. Touch is not only delicate, but intimate also. Do we not say about a moving experience, a book, a symphony, a film, a meeting with someone special, "It touched me"? Air and touch go deep. And just as air surrounds and penetrates every aspect of our being and life, so does and must intelligence. Let us see how it does so. Examining intelligence. We have our own individual intelligence, buddhi. This is the self-reflexive awareness, capable of making meaningful and freedom-enhancing choices, which we met previously. It is not to be confused with vidya, or knowledge, which is acquired from external sources and remains undecided, whereas the intelligence based on our own subjective experience is an internal one and always decisive. We must begin to understand that our individual intelligence, though an essential rudder to guide us, is merely a puny offshoot of cosmic intelligence, Mahat, which is the organizing system of the universe. This intelligence is everywhere, and like air, we constantly bathe in it and imbibe it. Of course we put barriers up against it, because we're so proud of our own individual and necessary intelligence. Thus we deprive ourselves of the full benefit of this infinite, universal, nourishing resource, just as we deprive ourselves of pranic energy from poor breathing. We saw how breath and consciousness go hand in hand. Similarly, individual intelligence and cosmic intelligence go hand in hand. Intelligence is the operating system of cosmic awareness. When we eat a head of lettuce, every leaf expresses the beauty and complexity of the cosmic intelligence which formed it, and so we are partaking of cosmic intelligence by ingesting it directly. The same for each perfect grain of rice, each generous fruit. At the biological level, we are preying on them. But at the level of intelligence and consciousness, we are collaborating with them in a sacred rite, for the intelligence which organized their form and function also organized ours. This extension of intelligence and expansion of consciousness brings the beginning of the end of loneliness. The lens of consciousness. The meaning of Hatha Yoga is sun, ha, and moon, ta. Yoga, in which sun is the soul and moon is consciousness. Consciousness can be compared to a lens. Its inner surface faces the soul itself, and its outer surface comes in contact with the world. Inevitably, a degree of grime attaches itself to that outer surface and obscures our vision. In fact, it prevents us seeing clearly what is outside, and it equally prevents the light of our soul from shining out. If our house is gloomy because the windows are dirty, we don't say there's a problem with the sun. We clean the windows. Therefore, yoga cleans the lens of consciousness in order to admit the sun, soul. So purity is not an end in itself. Similarly, when a woman in India washes and says prayers before preparing food, she is purifying herself, not for the sake of purity, but so that her intentions should be clearly transmitted, not perverted or obscured. The loving intention behind cooking is to sustain, nourish, and uphold others. This intention can be transmitted best through a pure or clean consciousness. Clean body, clean mind, clean hands, clean pots and pans equal a happy, healthy, loving family. What mind is and does dies with us. But consciousness is that aspect of mind, the envelope of continual awareness which endures, even as we believe from life to life, carrying the imprint of the past and the potential for good or ill of the future. Memory for past, imagination for future. Squashed between the two, we lose the ability to use direct perception on what really is, that is, now, the present. This brings us to the need to examine the nature of consciousness from a different perspective, not that of the polluting interference of the afflictions, kleshas, which we will look at next, but from that of five natural states of consciousness, which we all experience but tend to take for granted. Yoga says there's much to be learned from them, as they too are patterns of thought waves which influence the mind and its ability to perceive truly. If the reader is puzzled by this insistence on examining the myriad waves of thought which ruffle the lake of consciousness, let me remind you again of Patanjali's second sutra. Yoga is the stilling of the fluctuations of consciousness. Why? Because yoga is meditation, and this section is about concentration and meditation. A ruffled mind cannot meditate, which is why we must identify and pacify all disturbing patterns. The consciousness must become passively alert, not placid like a cow contentedly chewing the cud, but alert and receptive like a wild deer in the forest, except that whereas the deer's senses are turned outwards, the yogi's, with equal acuity, are directed inwards. This is intelligence enthroned in awareness, about to enter the mystery of the unknown. Yet our consciousness is not always alert, and so we must explore the modifications of our mind that prevent us from having this acuity. Transforming the mind. Consciousness, citta, has three functions. The first is cognition, which is perceiving, knowing, and recognizing. The second is volition, or will, which is the impulse to initiate action. The third is motion, which expresses the fire nature of mind, ever transforming itself and leaping up in different places and guises. These all serve for us to gain knowledge and appreciate the truth concerning humankind's position in the universe. Let us look at the fiery nature of mind. Fire flickers and dances, so does the mind. In fact, consciousness modifies itself so rapidly that before we can recognize one fluctuation and examine it, it gets muddled with another. These muddled changes are a natural process. They show the vivacity of consciousness. All our activities depend on these mental fluctuations. I have said that the mind dances. It would also be true to say that mind leads us on a merry dance. If you want to get the best out of a fiery horse, you have to understand, tame, and control it. The same is true for a fiery mind, or it will run away with you. Because mind is always drawn outwards by the senses into the attractions of the material world, it cannot help but land us into a lot of tricky situations, ones we had not bargained for, or which look good at first, but turn sour on us. The way Patanjali expresses this is to say that fluctuations of consciousness can either be painful or non-painful, either visible or invisible. He means that some things look unpleasing, distressing, anguishing, and they are. Studying for an exam can be very hard. The benefits of passing the exam remain hidden, invisible until later. Conversely, the joys of the table are extremely pleasant, and the pains and problems which result from overindulgence may remain invisible for a long time. If eventually an illness or debility results, then that is a visible pain. But if we use all our resources, courage, will, faith, to overcome the sickness, a non-painful state emerges again. This is a way of warning us that there are always two sides to every coin, and that we should be guarded and thoughtful before we rush into things. There is always a price to pay or a reward to be earned. But the phrase, "if it feels good, do it," is not in the long run a maxim to be trusted. All philosophies recognize that a pleasure seeker will end up as a pain finder. The ancient Greeks said that moderation was the greatest virtue. Yoga says that it is through practice and detachment that we learn to avoid ricocheting from one extreme of pleasure and pain to the other. This double aspect of the fluctuating mind applies to what are called the five modifications of consciousness, in Sanskrit called chittavrittis. These are correct knowledge, pramana, wrong knowledge or misconception, viparyaya, imagination or fantasy, vikalpa, sleep, nidra, memory, smriti. These are natural psychological states which occur in everyone. They are dependent on the brain and nervous system and disappear at death. One might be forgiven for wondering what the point is of studying them. Sleep is sleep. Imagination is imagination. And as regards to the first two, well, sometimes I am right and sometimes I'm wrong. Yet from the yoga standpoint, there's a huge value in understanding them. Their misuse, when they're defective, can lead to endless trouble. They affect both the quality of our life and the actions we perform in it. The consequences of our actions endure. The implications are karmic. As you sow, so shall you reap. This is a universal understanding. Yoga does not limit consequences to this life only. How does someone who is wrong about everything, lives in fantasies, sleeps badly, and misuses memory conduct himself? Hitler truly believed that the Jewish people were subhuman and acted accordingly. This was wrong knowledge or misperception, total delusion. The consequence in his lifetime was his death and his country's destruction along with much of the world. If the chain of causality does survive the grave, would anyone like to change places with Hitler now? It is definitely worth looking at these five forms of consciousness in both their beneficial and deficient aspects. Their study can help us to follow a certain way of life and adopt a right way of thinking. They show us a direction and enable us to channel the thinking process. Our aim is not to arrest or restrain them, but gradually to transform them. They are not separate, but intertwined like threads in a cloth. One affects the others. The dullness of poor quality, or tamasic sleep, degrades the clarity of the four other modifications. Sharp analysis for right knowledge becomes impossible. When you are tired, it is not easy to remember things. We also depend on memory to recall other states. It links and underpins them. We looked at the two aspects of memory, one damaging, the other liberating. We saw that the painful form of memory brings bondage and psychological time, condemning us to relive the past in endless, meaningless permutations. We are like a cart in the monsoon, its wheels bogged down in mud. The painless form is discrimination, viveka, essential for our growth. Discrimination is the knife edge of intellect, separating true from false, reality from unreality, using memory in such a way that past consequences are factored into our choices and decisions. If we can see consequences, we are not caught in the trap of apparent pain versus apparent pleasure. Discrimination is about making meaningful comparisons such as, how does my practice compare with that of yesterday? How does the stretch of my left leg compare with that on my right? You may well find the right leg is asleep. Initially, this is a process of trial and error. Later, we can learn to avoid error. In headstand, for example, something that usually goes wrong is that the upper arm shortens. Memory warns us to be careful before that happens. In this way, we break down bad habits. This is a useful discrimination which awakens awareness. Awareness, working with discrimination and memory, encourages a creative mind, not a mechanical one. The mechanical mind questions only external phenomena, treating the world like a giant machine and resulting in objective knowledge. By objective knowledge, I mean knowledge of the world around us. This can be useful or dangerous depending on how you use it. Comparing your neighbor's new car to your old one may lead to jealousy and covetousness, or it might lead you to appreciate that his is safer or causes less pollution. But what I call the creative brain calls into question both the outer and inner, leading us to subjective and spiritual knowledge. By subjective knowledge, I mean knowledge of oneself from the skin inwards. Take the example of your neighbor's car. If you have understood that pollution is undesirable, you will not want to pollute the atmosphere, outer, or pollute yourself, inner. So a creative reaction might be to change your car. When awareness is linked to intelligence, we are able to see with absolute honesty. When brain and body move in harmony, there's integrity. Memory supports this process because when memory functions perfectly, it becomes one with intelligence. By transferring its allegiance from the pleasure-seeking mind to the discerning intelligence, memory no longer digs pits of old habit for us to fall into, but becomes our true guru by guiding us toward perfect knowledge and behavior. By purifying memory, we purify our whole mind. For an average person, memory is a past state of mind. For the yogi, it is a present state of mind. We should not forget that memory records everything. Memory is useless if it brings about a repetition of the past, which impedes the process of our evolution. But memory is useful if it helps to prepare you for the future, and even necessary if you use it to develop. Memory is a continuous profit and loss account through which we can see whether we are receding or proceeding. By sorting out wanted from unwanted memory, we allow new experiences to surface. The whole of the useful past is now at our present disposition. Memory ceases to function as a separate entity and merges with consciousness. Patanjali says that when memory is cleansed completely, the mind drops like a ripe fruit, and consciousness shines in its purest form. By this I mean that when memory serves as a spur to perfect present action without taint, then it is acting in its intended form. A cleansed memory is one which does not contain undigested emotions from the unconscious, but which deals with feelings in the present as they arise. Imagination, too, can work either to our benefit or to our detriment. It is undoubtedly the greatest gift to human beings. But the Sanskrit word vikalpa also means fantasy or delusion. Without steady application, even the most inspiring flights of imagination must remain impotent, devoid of reality. If a scientist has an idea, he may have to labor for years, experimenting, analyzing, and checking in order to bring it to fruition, to make it concrete. A writer may dream of the plot for a new novel, but unless he applies himself to pen and paper, his ideas have no value. A callow youth once said to a great poet, "I have a marvelous idea for a new poem." The poet replied cuttingly, "Poems are about words." The true poet had his feet on the ground. Never mind the idea, write it down. You can see how the five modifications combine against us. When we daydream, we are mixing fantasy and the dullness of sleep. If we are daydreaming about the past, we add memory to the mixture. This may be pleasant and soothing, but it leads nowhere. In fact, when we return to present reality, we may find it, by comparison, quite unpalatable. This is a painful state emerging from a painless one. Those who fail to emerge from solely imaginative thoughts never command respect. They remain lightweights. We reserve our greatest respect for those who transform a panoramic and penetrating vision into a reality. As a young man, Mahatma Gandhi imagined an India independent and free of British rule. Yet it took him a lifetime of unremitting labor, of tapas, to realize his dream. Tapas is the key here. The word implies intense, purifying heat, a fire which, like the alchemist, transforms base metal into gold. Imagination is the flickering flame, the coolest part of the fire. Dancing flames give light to reveal shape, which in yoga terminology is the subtle counterpart of fire. What is an idea, a concept, but a shape in the mind? The work before us is to blow on the fire with the bellows of tapas so that it becomes intensely hot and transforms the shapes of mind into reality. Asana practice brings mind and body into harmony for this task. Your mind is always ahead of your body. The mind moves into the future, the body, the past. But the self is in the present. The coordination between them, which we learn in asana, will enable us to turn the shape of our vision into the substance of our life. Sleep is sleep. I said earlier, what can it teach us? After all, we never witness it. We are inert, unconscious, and have no direct memory of it. Yet we always know how we have slept. Deep, dreamless, nourishing sleep is worth hoping for. Yogis do not dream. Either they are in sleep or awake. Sleep is of three types. If one feels heavy and dull after sleep, then that sleep has been tamasic. Disturbed, agitated sleep is rajasic. Sleep that brings lightness, brightness, and freshness is sattvic. Sleep, to use the metaphor again, is like an open rose returning to the bud. The senses of perception rest in the mind in the consciousness in the being. This sounds like a description of exactly what we are trying to achieve through yoga, so surely there's something to be learned. We even return to innocence in sleep. No sleeper can be a sinner. Because the mind and senses are at rest, a negative state of void exists, a feeling of emptiness or absence. It can be described as negative because the present and aware state of consciousness is absent. The goal of the yoga student is to transform this into a positive state of mind while awake. The senses in the mind close up like a bud, but a witness remains alert. This is a pure state in which the self is free from the accumulations of experience. The movements of consciousness are calmed. Peaceful, deep sleep, experienced while alert and awake, is samadhi. When the mind is controlled and still, what remains is the soul. The absence of ego in the state of sleep is akin to samadhi, but it is dull and without awareness. Samadhi is the egolessness of sleep combined with the vibrancy of intelligence. When we are in deep sleep, we lose our ego, our I-ness. We forget who we are and return to the cosmic, eternal mind. There is a brief moment on awaking before I-consciousness returns, when we can just glimpse this tranquil, egoless state. It should be our guide. It is a natural window onto the meditative mind in which we realize that we are one and learn to accept. When the ego is quiescent, our sense of pride lessens. We are receptive and become more understanding. We are not offended by life's affronts. We become insulated from anxiety and anguish both within and without. The practice of yoga teaches us to deal with each task in the day as it arises and then to put it down. This might include answering our letters or returning our calls, doing the washing up, letting anger drop as soon as the moment is past. There's an old phrase, sufficient to the day, the evils thereof. It means we should contain even disagreeable challenges of life in their appropriate place and not let them fester and pollute the rest of our time. If we learn this, our sleep will not carry over a toxic hangover from the previous day of unresolved worries and fears. In a similar way, we should not eat heavily or too late, as our sleep will be turbulent, rajasic. We will awake in a discontented, agitated state. If we feed our mind on violent images, thoughts, and words, our unconscious will regurgitate them in disturbed dreams. Just as right imagination opens the creative mind, right sleep exhilarates the mind and brings alertness. By living each day presently and thoroughly, we earn a clear conscience. A clear conscience is the best preparation for a restful and peaceful night. It is sometimes said that a dullard, someone who is completely vacuous, presents to the observer the same appearance as one who is in samadhi, a state of divine bliss. This is because neither the dullard's mind nor the saint's has movement in the consciousness. The difference is that one is negative, comatose, insensitive, the other alert, positive, supremely aware. I mention this because it is easy for beginners to confuse somnolence or pleasant languor with the meditative state. Often as students do shavasana or attempt meditation, they drift into an agreeable torpor, as if they were swaddled in cotton wool. This is not the prelude to samadhi, but to sleep. The dullness of sleep is undesirable in a waking state. So is the frenetic overactivity which arises from turbulent sleep. If we toss and turn at night, we shall toss and turn in the day. What we are seeking is an alert, self-contained, egoless state which corresponds to the refreshing aftermath of good repose. The experience of repose at night will give us clues to the repose of mind and sense in the meditative state. Good sleep makes consciousness brilliant. Poor sleep leaves it tarnished. A bad night makes us see everything askew. Erroneous knowledge gives rise to erroneous thought, words, and action. They are not harmless. Often, when we correct our misperceptions, we look back and say, I shouldn't have said that, or I shouldn't have done this. We feel guilt and regret. Yet in the practical world, we put a lot of effort into avoiding this situation. If we are buying a house, we employ a surveyor to check its structure, the safety of the land, and the supply of water, and a title company to verify the legal deeds, and a bank to carry out the financial transaction correctly. We check availability of schools and transport. We don't want to make a mistake. Yet most people, looking back on their lives, see them as being littered with mistakes. We say, if I'd only known then what I know now. But what we know now does not seem to stop us making more mistakes. The yogic blueprint says that right knowledge and erroneous knowledge are two modifications or states of consciousness. By the practice of yoga, we can lessen and eradicate misperception and wrong knowledge and gain accurate perception and right knowledge. I am not talking about changing our opinions, although this may happen, but rather about abandoning them altogether. An opinion is yesterday's right or wrong knowledge, warmed up and reserved for today's situation. So opinions are rooted in the past, and our examination of memory has shown us that the past can be a minefield. The practitioner of yoga is always trying to be in the present, which is where reality is, and so perfect present awareness is a given situation in his goal. This is not to be reached in one bound. So one of the things we may notice about ourselves on the inward journey is that opinions based on wrong perception and information are gradually replaced by those with a more accurate foundation. This is akin to a situation where we changed bad habits into good ones prior to reaching an unconditioned freedom. Let us look at an example. 30 or 40 years ago, most people held the view that women were not able to do men's jobs, that they were more suited to subservient tasks, and that even if they did a man's job, they should receive less pay. Most people no longer believe this. The climate of opinion has changed, and we would say that the current evidence confirms our change of opinion. We consider this progress away from erroneous knowledge. It is based on actual evidence of how women perform in the workplace, and so is less shackled to prejudice. Prejudice means making up your mind before you look. During this process of change, if a man and woman came to you for a job, you might have been inclined, all other things being equal, to favor the woman, consciously trying to act out of the new view of women's capabilities and perhaps to redress past injustice. But if you favor the woman when the candidates are equal, you are still acting out of prejudice. The past still has its hold. You have effectively turned a bad habit into a better one. But where is the right action based on right knowledge without previous conditioning? In this example, presumably the solution is to be able to interview the candidates with such clarity of vision as regards their abilities and suitability that a choice emerges, but without any shadow of reference to their gender. This example is external. Yoga practice is internal. What we have to look at now is how the culture of the self leads to direct, right knowledge, which then inevitably reforms and transforms our relationship with the external world, as well as furthering our inner quest. According to yoga philosophy, correct knowledge is based on three kinds of proof: direct perception, correct deduction, and testimony from authoritative sacred scriptures or wise, experienced people. Initially, therefore, individual perception should be checked by logic and reason and then seen to correspond to traditional wisdom. We are all familiar with this process. In the example of buying a house, we see the house and form an impression, our direct perception. We then make an assessment based on what we learn about the house, hopefully correct deduction. The surveyor is our experienced sage, and his technical reference books are the scriptures. In this way, the three kinds of proof ideally corroborate one another. The faculty you are using here is intelligence, buddhi, which we saw in the last section, to be more subtle than the thinking sensorial brain, manas. It is concerned with facts and reason, not impressions and interpretations. It is inherent in every aspect of our being, but tends to remain dormant. So our first step is to tap into it and awaken it. The practice of asana brings intelligence to the surface of the cellular body through stretching and to the physiological body through maintaining the asana. Once awakened, the body can reveal its dynamic aspect, its ability to discriminate. Here the body is providing subjective factual truth while the mind is generating imaginative ideas. It is the precise thorough measuring and adjustment of a pose, bringing balance, stability, and equal extension everywhere, which hones this faculty of discrimination. Discrimination is a weighing process belonging to the world of duality. When what is wrong is discarded, what is left must be correct. As intelligence expands in consciousness, then ego and mind contract to their proper proportions. They no longer rule the roost, but serve intelligence. Memory especially, as we have seen, is now harnessed to the freedom-seeking intelligence, not the bondage-seeking mind. Prajna, insight and intuition. There is a further stage. Spiritual intelligence, which is true wisdom, dawns only when discrimination ends. Wisdom does not function in duality. It perceives only oneness. It does not discard the wrong. It sees and feels only the right. When we are buying a house, we need to use the logical discriminating intelligence. A politician, however high his motives, must choose and decide in the relative and temporal world. Spiritual wisdom, on the other hand, does not decide. It knows. It is entirely present, and so is free of time, as we shall see as we move inwards closer to the soul. For the moment, we must be content to see the sky clearly and say that it is blue when the sun shines. Ultimately, science tells us, the atmosphere is colorless like water. Sensory perception may be flawed, but at least clear, healthy senses will show us the wonderful variety of color in the sky or in the waters of rivers and lakes. This knowledge is not perfect, but it is valid. It provides a reasonable foundation. A good nervous system will make our actions swift and sure. A healthy body gives strength to act, an unclouded mind, stability and relief from emotional upheavals. The awakening of intelligence will help us to choose, decide, and initiate action. What we are witnessing is a coming together, an integration of the sheaths of being which we are exploring, so that they can act in harmony and from a source which is moving ever closer to the core. What I am describing here is a journey from a chattering brain to clean instinct to reach the clarity of intuition. When you start yoga, you probably are living in your mind and emotion, a never-ending internet chat room. You read books and articles on what best to eat and how to exercise, reading material which any wild animal would scorn. But you do not know how to live, only what you desire. Instinct is dulled. With asana and pranayama practice, first we move outwards from the mind and cleanse the body, senses, and organs. Instinct is revitalized. The newly awoken intelligence of the body moves in and tells you automatically what food is good for you, when and how much to eat, when and how to exercise, and when to rest or sleep. People forget that in our quest for the soul, we first reclaim the pristine joys of the animal kingdom, health and instinct, vibrant and alive. At the same time, we are transforming instinct into intuition. Intelligence cuts its teeth on analysis and synthesis, reason and deduction. It becomes muscular. And gradually, the higher intelligence of intuition begins to dawn, like light in the sky before sunrise. Instinct is the unconscious intelligence of the cells surfacing. Intuition is superconscious knowing, in which you know before you know how you know. Misconception creates a distortion of reality, which in turn generates wrong feelings and taints the consciousness. By cultivating intelligence and learning from mistakes, we weed out what is wrong. Any gardener will tell you that weeds grow back, but at least they are easier to dig up if we catch them before they are fully grown. As we move farther inward, through the intellectual sheath, this intelligence is cultivated into wisdom. Here we will see the importance that concentration and meditation play in culturing the mind. By moving ever away from the understandable but often childish promptings of ego, we turn our source of knowing from our brain to our heart, and from our mind to our soul. Just as our soul is a part of the universal soul, we have also seen that our intelligence is a part of universal intelligence. As we learn to attune ourselves like an antenna to this natural intelligence around us, we gain not just clarity of thought, but also wisdom in life. We are able to develop ever greater access to this wisdom as we learn to develop right perception. We are also much more likely to perceive this wisdom as we learn to transform the dull, distracted, or oscillating mind into an attentive and restrained yogic mind. The five qualities of mind, bhumis. In order to make us more aware of consciousness as an ocean with wave patterns constantly moving across it, yoga has highlighted five calibers or qualities of mind which correspond to the five modifications we have been discussing. They include a dull state, a distracted monkey mind, an alternating or oscillating mind, a single-pointed attentive mind, and finally the highest stage, the restrained consciousness, which is experienced in the timeless state of absorption we call samadhi. These calibers of consciousness are aids to self-observation and self-knowledge, not accusations of mental debility. There's a popular misconception that yoga is only for those who have power of concentration, but all of us are not so endowed. Yoga can be practiced by anyone, whatever one's state of mind or health. It is through practice that the scattered mind is brought to a focal point, knee, chest, etc. This is a training regime that moves us toward direct perception. Humor helps people move from fragmentation to wholeness, too. It lightens the mind and makes it easier to guide and focus. A stable mind is like the hub of a wheel. The world may spin around you, but the mind is steady. Humorists are very observant of fluctuating consciousness. Their subject matter is frequently dull or silly people, or those with wandering minds, constantly making illogical jumps and associations. They cleverly show how ridiculous this is. And all the time the humorist is mimicking the dull and distracted, he himself is acutely concentrated in presenting his material. And as we laugh and lighten our minds, we in turn concentrate on every word he is saying. Clever people make fortunes out of understanding the tricks of the mind. Artists, too, are aware of the caliber of consciousness of their audience. An English writer said 200 years ago that there are four classes of reader. The first he compares to an hourglass. Their reading being as the sand. It runs in and it runs out and leaves not a vestige behind. A second class resembles a sponge, which imbibes everything and returns it in nearly the same state, only a little dirtier. A third class he likens to a jelly bag, which allows all that is pure to pass away and retains all the refuse and the dregs. The fourth class may be compared to the slaves in the diamond mines of Golconda, who, casting aside all that is worthless, preserve only the pure gems. As it happens, the diamond mines of Golconda are not very far from where I was born. But what, in yogic terms, and at this fourth level of our being, which we are examining, do we mean by diamonds? Diamonds are hard and clear. It is their property of clarity which gives us the clue. Clarity is also the great defining characteristic of wisdom. We are seeking to cultivate wisdom, to transform mental dexterity or cleverness, which all people possess in some degree, into the penetrating, clear light of wisdom. The culture of intelligence. I sometimes tell my pupils that the practice they do in class is not, strictly speaking, yoga practice. The reason for this is that in a class, although you are undoubtedly doing and hopefully learning, you are subordinate to the teacher. The directing intelligence comes from him, and you follow to the best of your ability. At home, on the other hand, it is your intelligence which is the master, and the progress which you make is yours and will be maintained. In addition, the will that you employ is yours. It is not derived from the power, the charisma, the strength, or the fieriness of the teacher. It comes from you, and its effect is difficult to underestimate. This is not yoga by the body, for the body, but yoga by the body, for the mind, for the intelligence. There is a great difference between just practicing and sadhana. Sadhana is the way of accomplishing something. That something is, by effective performance and correct execution, the achievement of the real. What is real must be true and so lead us towards purity and emancipation. This is yoga sadhana, and not the mechanical repetition merely of yoga practice or yoga bhyasa. The end of yoga sadhana is wisdom. You might translate yoga sadhana here as the yoga pilgrimage, as it is a journey which leads somewhere, not the mere treadmill of thoughtless practice. When I say a phrase like, wisdom comes from culturing the intelligence, everybody nods in agreement, but really, we are in danger of overinflating our minds. So let us just pause to steady ourselves as we do in asana and explore what we mean by intelligence. For example, one root way to grasp its meaning is to say that intelligence is sensitivity in the body that is felt by the consciousness and conscience. Conscience is very close to the self, as we will see shortly. Through the sensitivity you gain in asana practice, you can also diagnose where sensation is absent. This is the function of intelligence, sifting the earth in the minds of Golconda. Its next function is to bring sensation to where it is not and to make awareness flow there too. And when sensation is general, you are a sensate being, which means you are alive, perhaps for the first time since your birth. Beyond that, you have to observe whether the sensitivity is equally distributed or not. Intelligence here is the will to alter where it finds imperfections. The rapid, dexterous mind works in the service of intelligence, training itself to collect its scattered thoughts and apply itself to the greater good, which is the good of the whole. Mind is necessary to fabricate the grammar, syntax, and vocabulary with which we establish relations with other forms of life. Even the highest form of intelligence should not forget to be grateful to its feeling, gathering mind, for it needs, above all, to borrow the words and grammar afforded by the mind in order to express itself outwardly. At this level of practice, where total attention is almost within our grasp and total penetration is becoming a real possibility, there's something of a parting of the ways concerning what is called free will. Free will for most people implies being able, for good or ill, to do what we want and not to do what we don't. Our yoga practice up till now, we will have enhanced these potentials. Growing health, vigor, brightness, and self-control will have enabled us to take on more and different activities than before, change the quality of our relationships, and of course, put the ice cream back in the fridge. All this comes into most people's idea of self-realization, and it is a pleasant and essential aspect of living one's life. But now another side of free will is beginning to declare itself, and you might call that the will to be free. In spite of its attractive sound, it is, to the average person, a daunting prospect, implying as it does, penetration into the heart of the unknown, detachment, and the potential pain of ultimate self-knowledge. This requires real guts, so we should take a moment to look at the source of our will. The simple fact is that the will of the ego is finite, because our ego is finite. It is a personal attribute limited to us. It is just the sum of all our past experiences and acquisitions. Coming from the head, it will always feel forced. Coming from a finite origin, it will always eventually run out. The will that springs from the intelligence of the heart is, by contrast, linked to an infinite resource, cosmic intelligence, Mahat, and cosmic consciousness. It is a well which will never run dry. People who are addicted to drugs or alcohol are encouraged not to do what is called white-knuckle self-control, as its egoic source will eventually be exhausted and a crash will follow. On the contrary, they are told to hand over to a higher power, which means that their will is replenished every day through contact with the cosmic source of intelligent action. This is the intelligent will of nature's consciousness expressing itself through us. And it expresses itself through the heart, not the head. It is by tapping the source of infinite will and intelligence that we discover in ourselves the guts to penetrate the inner recesses of our being. The intelligence we are now developing depends on emotional and moral maturity, the ability to value truth and respect ethical conduct, the capacity to feel love in its more universal sense as compassion. Socrates admonished us to know thyself. But what is now revealed as the value of knowing yourself? It must have some point. Socrates said quite simply that self-knowledge allows us to live deliberately out of a state of freedom. The analogy I offer to explain the significance of the word deliberately is that most of us travel through life in the same way an 18-month-old baby walks. The reason he keeps putting one foot in front of the other is that if he doesn't, he will fall over. His walk is a sustained totter, punctuated by falls. To live deliberately is to walk like an adult, to have balance, direction, and purpose, and to walk in growing freedom and assurance towards the ultimate freedom. Sanskrit etymology throws light on the point we have now reached. I have just said that we are learning to walk as adults. Well, in Sanskrit, manava means man. By association with manas, it also means one who has a mind. Another meaning of mana is to live with honor and dignity. The implication is clear. We are human beings gifted with intelligence which lends purpose and direction to our steps, striving to live ethically, that is, with honor and dignity. The question which hangs over mankind is, can we really achieve freedom? We often hold the contradictory notion in our heads that Gandhi or Jesus or Aurobindo reached freedom, but that we cannot. And our daily experiences, our failures, and disappointments only seem to confirm our prejudice against ourselves. But read the life of Gandhi, of Aurobindo. Their lives were full of setbacks, wrong paths embarked upon, even early immorality. I've already made it clear that the basis of my life in yoga was sickliness, ostracism, ridicule, and my general uselessness for any other path in life. To resolve this paradox, we have to cast our minds back to the relationship between nature, prakriti, and soul, purusha. Here we have to discriminate between determinism and inevitability. We are biologically determined by nature for our own evolutionary benefit. At the biological level, this determinism is so strong that it creates inevitability. That is, we all have two arms, two legs, and one head, etc. At the level of consciousness, deterministic forces produce a strong predisposition in us. For example, to repeat pleasure, avoid pain, flee what we fear, allow ego and pride to swell. But this is not inevitable. It is merely an unlevel playing field. Yoga is a thoroughly tested technique whereby the will, working through an intelligence which can choose and a self-awareness consciousness, can free us from inevitability. By these means, we can walk deliberately towards an individual emancipation, and by the grace of heaven, a universal freedom. It is said that Adam and Eve lived in a state of primal or original oneness. Yoga says that the highest experience of freedom is oneness, the supreme reality of unity. The predicament of human beings is that we feel ourselves to be stuck in a no-man's land, between the beginning and the end of an immense journey. Adam and Eve took the first step towards individuation when they ate the forbidden fruit and lost their primal unity. We are still carrying on their arduous journey. We cannot go back. Where we are is uncomfortable, so we must go on. On the way, we will taste both the sweet and bitter fruits of individuation, and they will be included and integrated in our experience of the journey towards full consciousness. But nothing says we cannot reach the goal of oneness, paradise regained, a final, not a primal, unity. To make such a long journey, we need power. In fact, we need three powers, Shakti. Power and wisdom, Shakti. Previously, we established the vital importance of the power of pranic energy, pranashakti. Now I introduce another power, that of awareness, prajna. Prajna is awareness of consciousness. I mentioned it only a few paragraphs ago as self-aware consciousness, but did not give the Sanskrit translation. The power of self-awareness is prajna shakti. Prajna is also translated as knowledge of wisdom. These three powers have first to be brought into alignment in order to coordinate with the power of the soul, Atma Shakti, so that they may merge with it. Body power plus energy can overload the system by putting too high a voltage through an inadequate circuit. It is by adding the power of the awareness of consciousness that we balance these huge forces within us. This makes possible expansion at every level, kosha, but without danger, strain, or overload. The role of awareness is to fill the gaps which inevitably exist between the physical, bones, muscles, etc., and organic, for example, organs, sheaths of our body when we practice asana. Even when we are integrating the various sheaths of our body, there are gaps which we fail to fill with awareness and energy. The constant practice of all the petals of yoga will eventually repair all flaws inherent within the human system. The power we generate through yoga practice must become a coherent and indissoluble whole. Yoga sadhana is meant to knit the fibers to the skin and skin to the fibers so that they coil and interweave the outer koshas into the Atma kosha. Only then can the oneness of the power we create within ourselves be integrated with the universal power which surrounds us. If not, divisions will inevitably remain. Prajna Shakti, the power of awareness, is nothing less than cosmic intelligence seeping and soaking into the dark spaces of our being to illuminate them with consciousness. Consciousness has to settle down with clarity, brightness, and serenity. This renders a gratifying satisfaction to the conscience, which is egoless and very close to the soul. In practical terms, how does this work? We already know the cosmic energy, prana, is carried into us by the vehicle of breath. So how is cosmic awareness inducted into us? What fuels it? The fuel is willpower or sustained intention with attention. See how we're moving closer to concentration, dharana, the sixth petal of yoga? But still you must be asking, how do I ignite the fuel of my willpower? I know it comes from the heart, not the head, but I cannot just conjure it up from thin air. Yes, you can, for it is air, or rather prana, which ignites the fuel of will and allows awareness to spread and percolate throughout our system. Energy and awareness, both cosmic entities, act as friends. Where one goes, the other follows. It is by the will of awareness to penetrate that intelligence is able to move into and occupy the darkest inner recesses of our being. This intelligence is clarity to lighten the darkness. This is the dawn of wisdom, the intuitive insight which sees because it sees, knows because it knows, and acts immediately and spontaneously, because the three powers of body, energy, and awareness have merged and aligned themselves with the light emitted by the soul. We say that intelligence has insight. We should complement that by saying that the soul has outsight. It is a beacon shining out. During the inward journey, as our will goes inward, our soul comes outward to meet us. I have talked a lot on freedom from various angles. Something we all associate with freedom is space. Americans refer nostalgically to the space and freedom of the Old West. Space is freedom, and we create, like a big bang, space within by the practice of asana and pranayama. A dark space is unknown and unknowing, avidya. But when the power of energy and the power of awareness combine, there's a flash of lightning which banishes darkness. It is by the exercise of our drive toward consciousness that we witness this. It is a subjective revelation as no one else can witness it or corroborate it. But is it not also true that if you have a toothache, no one else can feel it? Yet no authority on earth can convince you that your tooth does not hurt? We use the phrase, the inward journey, a lot.